This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Healthy Aging, providing you with the unique energy support of Pure NT Factor. NT Factor is the only nutritional formula clinically proven to reduce fatigue, whatever the cause, whether it be age, illness, or just being run down. NT Factor from Nutritional Therapeutics repairs damaged cells and restores healthy bacteria in your digestive tract. Clinical trials have shown NT Factor reduces fatigue by almost half, and it even reverses some symptoms of aging. I've been taking NT Factor for years with a 45-day money-back guarantee of nothing to lose. To order, call 800-982-9158. That's 800-982-9158. Or go to ntfactor.com. That's ntfactor.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and here we are once again. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla, and I swore a while ago that I was going to stop talking about the weather, but...
I haven't stopped talking about the weather.
during the valuable time of these podcasts, yeah. But I tell you, it's getting kind of demoralizing here.
It is.
And, you know, I'm reflecting on this. It is depressing and aggravating, and you know, so much in life, you know, you say, this too shall pass. And things, you don't know sometimes, you know, an illness or a personal crisis. And you say that, you know, with the faith that it will pass. Now, we know that this will pass.
Yes.
We'll be sitting here in August and we'll be complaining about the heat. But I tell you, it's been such a prolonged, damp, cold spring here in the Northeast. I went to the Yankee game the other night. And thank goodness they were ahead 12-1 in the sixth inning so I could leave because I was freezing.
It was time to go.
Sitting there in the stands and I was like blowing on my fingers. And
I'm tired of wearing a hat. I'm done.
Yeah. So anyway, we dispense with the weather. let's tell our listeners that you can send questions to us via radioprogram@AOL.com. That's radio program at AOL. And for all I know, you know, some of our listeners may be listening to us from Saudi Arabia or from, you know, Arizona, where the temperatures are warm.
Yeah.
You know? But out here in the Northeast, where possibly a preponderance of our listeners are, big listenership here in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, you know, East Coast, it's been cold, inordinately cold. And in the Midwest, too. And a lot of baseball games canceled or baseball games being played in 30-degree weather. Yikes.
That's
what's
tough.
What's up with that?
Yeah.
So before we get into our questions, I just want to share a little item it's a study. And I did an article on this a little while ago. Like, what are the predictors of longevity? So, for example, how long can you stand on one foot? How fast can you cover a certain distance?
Mm-hmm.
Various ways of determining your grip strength is
another
one.
That's a proxy.
But then, you know, what it turns out is that affluence, of course, has a lot to do with longevity.
Mm-hmm.
But
access to care and
Access to care is important, but access to care, according to a Medicare study recently, a Medicaid study. And it showed that while people got more access to Medicaid under some new, Obamacare extended Medicaid to more people, it did not improve their health. So they thought they weren't getting bang for their buck.
Yeah, but the affluent aren't on Medicaid.
Right.
So just affluence alone having access to.
Right. And maybe really high quality. Yeah. I mean, that's a theory.
Yeah.
But here's an interesting, they broke it down. This is from the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis. That's a fancy title. Education, not income, is the best predictor of a long life. So while it's true that the more affluent have, generally they eat better, they're more health conscious, you know, we have a reverse scenario in this country in this century, whereas in the past the poor were hungry and the affluent were corpulent.
Yes.
You know, now it's the opposite. Is the rich are sleek and thin. They go to gyms.
Right.
They eat like gluten-free, you know, salad and, you know, arugula, and the poor, unfortunately, eat a lot of junk food and fast food.
Overnutrition, but still poor nutrition,
But what, and I forgive the expression, education trumps income.
Mm.
As forgive the verb, education trumps income as the best predictor of a long life. And what that speaks to is really what this program is all about. We call this intelligent medicine. Mm. And so that's why I like to point out this feature is that intelligence actually helps you live longer.
Yes.
Because you end up learning more, making more prudent choices.
Yeah.
Perhaps, that is a part of our intelligent medicine portfolio, is that we're extending longevity via imparting useful information mm-hmm. to people who have the capacity to absorb it and apply it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes total sense.
Yeah.
Actually, the more you do, the more you know, the better you'll do.
And I think we can also use the term health literacy.
Yes.
Here, because health literacy corresponds generally to educational attainment. Mm-hmm. And the more health literacy you have, the better you're able to, cope with medical challenges and move on.
Yeah, as a contrast, financial literacy.
Right.
The more financially literate you are, the better you're going to handle your budget, your finances, all of that. You're simply going to do better. So.
That's what my broker tells me, but it hasn't worked out well so far. But anyway, so...
That's what your broker's for.
Right, right, yeah. So they say. So, I think it underlines the importance of, having training in health literacy for the general populace. There's not enough of that. There are real gaps in health literacy. Some mm-hmm. studies really show that people don't know a lot.
Yeah.
They don't know a lot about, some of the basic facts of human physiology. They mm-hmm. see drug ads. They believe them implicitly. Mm-hmm. They don't look at findings critically. Think that, just have all kinds of misconceptions about health. That's what we're trying to set right and dispel here. And
yes.
Point people in the right direction. Mm-hmm. So that article we'll post. It was posted on Facebook recently, and we'll provide you with a link at drhoffman.com to that article. So let's hear from some of our listeners what we have in the mailbag.
Okay, we have an email from Sandy. Would you please discuss Kratom for pain control? What do you think of it?
Well, Kratom, I mean, I don't know much about it, but I've looked at articles about it. It's an herb.
Yeah.
From, I think, Southeast Asia?
Yes. Yeah. Native to Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, Papua New Guinea.
And it's supposed to have a sedating effect and a, analgesic effect.
Yeah.
And it was proposed for a while that it was a plausible alternative to opioids.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe in terms of risk abatement, it's sort of like, let's have you get hooked on something that's a little less dangerous or toxic.
Yeah.
But what's the story on that?
But apparently, as reported in February of this year, the FDA confirmed from analysis that Kratom has opioid properties.
Right.
So
it's addictive.
What are we talking about?
It's addictive.
Is it addictive the way methadone is also addictive if you're getting... Yeah, it's that kind of a thing.
Right. But also the concern is for adulteration, mm-hmm. standardization. It's not, you don't know what you're getting.
Yeah.
And it's been outlawed.
Not only do you not know what you're getting.
Do we see any bad consequences?
Yes, something happened. CDC reported it was investigating a multi-state outbreak of 28 salmonella infections.
Oh, lovely.
In 20 states linked to Kratom use.
Oh, so it's impure too.
Right,
contaminated.
Right. So 11 people have been hospitalized with salmonella illness linked to Kratom.
Mm.
No deaths, fortunately, were reported.
Right.
So
you don't really know what you're getting.
No,
That's not great.
Now, it's also got a list of side effects and health hazards.
Let's hear it.
Loss of appetite, constipation, confusion, dry mouth. I think everything causes dry mouth, doesn't
right.
it? Sedation, nausea, sweating, increased urination, itching, and all of that. So, Kratom addiction and chronic use has led to cases of psychosis with hallucinations, delusions, confusion. And a high dose may lead to a fast heartbeat, tachycardia, mm-hmm. and low blood pressure. tremor, anorexia, weight loss, or other possible side effects with long-term use.
Yes, so we might suggest as a less dangerous alternative, maybe the cannabinoids, you know, some form of marijuana medicine, mm-hmm. but in particular CBD, although CBD is not very strong. I can't really see
CBD. Because it's from the hemp plant.
Yeah, it's legal.
And marijuana is from the cannabis
right.
plant. So but it's almost different.
It's the same genus.
Genus? Okay.
Cannabis sativa.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
But it's just very different manifestations of that. So
Sandy, bottom line, the FDA has warned consumers not to use any products labeled as containing kratom.
Yeah, and I think the kratom market is going to become crash and it will be illicit and illegal and hard to source. But, you know, there's always a market for illicit things and it'll be floating around, but I don't recommend it.
Yeah.
And it's herbal, but, you know, not everything from Mother Nature is good for you.
Exactly. I mean, all right. So our next question is from Randy. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, I take between 5,000 and 10,000 IU of vitamin D3 each day. I also live in the South. I walk about an hour a day. But the best result I've been able to get is my vitamin D is as high as only a 38 NG per ml, not the minimal. So is there something wrong or should I try a different vitamin D supplement?
Okay. So let me try to explain.
Yeah.
For some people, it takes more vitamin D to achieve an optimal level of vitamin D, which might be 40 or 50. Now, 38's not bad. Mm-hmm. It just may be slightly suboptimal. And so there seem to be several reasons for that. And maybe you can chime in if you can think of anything else. Number one, it's whether it's absorbed by mouth. And some people, they're taking acid blockers, they have poor digestion.
Malabsorption.
Or maybe the product is not even formulated well to break up. Although usually that's not a problem with vitamin D. So people who have fat malabsorption, it's a fat-soluble nutrient. So if they have had pancreatitis or if they have any of the conditions that cause fat malabsorption, that may be a problem. So that's number one. So number two is there seems to be issues with the carrier of vitamin D in the bloodstream that takes it, you know, to where it needs to go. And that varies. And actually, it's been thought that that varies racially so that African-Americans often have lower vitamin D. This was attributed to the fact that African-Americans don't bother to go and tan themselves obsessively like light-skinned people because they're already tan.
Yeah.
You know, so what's the point? In fact, they buy skin lightener sometimes to get lighter.
And in addition, they would need six times as much time in the sun as a light-skinned
Which is an
person.
Evolutionary adaptation to walking around nearly naked in the equatorial regions so that the skin is sort of protected from the sun's rays. So there's dark pigment, which protects the skin.
Yep.
Anyway, so that's why also Nordic people are very pale. So the very little bit of sunlight is required to trigger vitamin D production. They tan more easily and burn more easily. So, okay, that's number two. And number three, and this probably isn't reflected in a blood test, but in terms of the efficacy of vitamin D, there's something called a vitamin D receptor, which genetically is variable.
BDR.
And that, you probably won't see, the BDR, and you won't see probably a change in your vitamin D levels in your bloodstream, but you might need more vitamin D to get the job done.
Yes.
Let's put it that way. So in other words, the vitamin D receptors in your bone or the vitamin D receptors in your brain or wherever in the vitamin D receptors are ubiquitous throughout the body. They may not get charged up with the vitamin D seems to be adequate. So some people need more. And I think a fourth thing that we can mention, and there are probably many more other things, is that I believe, and some people have corroborated this, is that people who are sick or have an inflammatory state or they're fighting off something, they need more vitamin D.
Yeah, it's being used up.
It's being used up. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. It's the antibiotic vitamin. The other thing, Randy, are you on certain medications that are inhibiting your use of vitamin D, like anti-seizure medications, steroid medications, things like that? Also, obesity, Fat cells sequester vitamin
D. Exactly. And we don't know what his dimensions are.
Exactly. Now, Randy walks about an hour each day. I would ask you, what time of day is your walk?
Yeah.
It should be between 11 a.m. and 1 p.m.
Right.
Without any sunblock. But he's taking all this vitamin D3, and it's not. So I think it's more, is there any inflammatory bowel disease? That's also another contributor to low vitamin D levels. Yeah. These would be it. All right. 38 is not terrible. We do call it deficient, but we like to see numbers anywhere between 50 and 80, 85.
So I'll give you a little instance for something that happened this morning in the office, because we're in the office recording this. We had a patient come in, and she said, I'm taking 5,000 international units of vitamin D, but I got tested, and they said my level was 200, and it's much too high.
Wow.
So so I thought about that. I said, that's really weird, because when people take 5,000,
it's not going
to
reach.
They're rarely going to go to 200. We consider 100 or more potentially toxic. But 200, I've never seen with 5,000.
Yeah.
Maybe I've seen once or twice people taking 5,000 if they were 106 or 112
or something like that, yeah.
But most people, 5,000 gets them, 60, 70, 80.
Yeah.
And we have some patients take 5,000 and they don't get to the right level. So we say take 5 alternating with 10 like this guy is.
Right, right.
We need
like
more.
Randy is. Yeah.
When we want to replace vitamin D for a very low vitamin D, we say take 50,000 once a week. We give them a 50,000 pill. That's 7,000 a day. And we tell them to do that for several weeks until they normalize their vitamin D. Then they can go on maintenance of maybe anywhere, 4 to 5,000 a day for maintenance. 5,000 usually does the trick. So then I thought, something? They use different units in different parts of the world. So I said, where'd you get that test? He said, I had it done in England. So I looked at the units that they use there.
Yeah.
And in order to convert that system to our system, you'd have to divide by, 2.3 or something
2.6.
Like 2.6.
2.6,
okay.
I think that's the factor.
So there's actually a conversion table in the, that you can just do a plug-in.
Yeah.
So I plugged in 200 and did the conversion, and that's 80.
Mm.
So when they told her it's much too high, actually, they were speaking to a level of 80, which probably surprised them because very few people in England have levels that high.
Yeah.
And it freaked them out, but it's an okay level.
It is absolutely
an okay level. We do see that too. We see people, I went to my doctor and he says, your vitamin D is astronomical. It's too high. Take less vitamin
D.
It's
50. It's too high.
Yeah, it's 70. It's 70. Oh my goodness. Right? So.
Exactly.
Yeah. Anyway.
So. Anyway, so Randy, these are the things to for you to consider, everything that we talked about why your levels may...
I think Dr. Cannell did a study. He's an expert on vitamin D, and he found that even if you take 2,000 a day, only about a third of people will reach the optimal level, which is over 40.
Yeah. I've only seen that rarely, with only 2,000 a day.
Yeah,
only rarely, anything below 20, we consider an emergency. So you have to take at least 5,000 a day. 5,000 would be good.
Yeah.
Barring all the other issues that may
interfere
with the absorption of that.
Good. So that prompted a nice discussion of vitamin D.
Yeah.
Great question.
Yeah.
These people ask good questions.
They do. They do. We've got an email from Joel. Dr. Hoffman and Layla, I ran across this article that's contrary to everything you've been saying about the effects of fat in the diet on cardiovascular disease. Are they just out of touch with the latest findings, or is there some validity to this perspective? Now, here's a study. Here's the title. A single high-fat meal increases risk for heart disease.
That's old, by the way. That's like 5 years old.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, high-fat meals trigger bodily responses that may lead to heart disease, according to a study published in Laboratory Investigation. Now, this is what they did. Researchers compared blood labs and blood cells in 10 healthy men before and after each consumed one high-fat milkshake.
Okay.
The confounders.
Yeah, well, just a second. The experiment was they looked at the blood cells in the test tube or in the bodies?
Let's see. Blood labs and blood cells.
Okay.
So I think they look both in the lab and in their serum.
Okay, what did they find again?
Yeah. So what they found was increased cholesterol, triglycerides.
Right. Transient.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Fatty acid levels 4 hours after consumption.
Right.
And they observed changes in red blood cell structure and increased enzymes associated with the red blood cells, associated with oxidative stress.
Right, okay.
Arterial plaque, all of that. But they used a milkshake.
Right. So exactly, it probably wasn't just pure fat.
No, it was all that sugar.
So when you combine fat with a lot of sugar, that's a bomb for the arterial wall.
Yeah. And it's not just the sugar.
That's why Americans who are on a high-fat diet get problems, because it's variably a high-fat diet is not a ketogenic diet.
It's a high-carbohydrate diet. Yeah. So not only is the sugar...
And hypercaloric.
Hypercaloric. So the milkshake, not just the sugar in the milkshake, but the lactose also in the milkshake. It's like a double whammy of sugar right there. Mm-hmm. How are they able to discern what is actually causing it, whether it's the fat or whether it's the sugar?
Right.
If I was a gambler, I would bet my money it's the sugar.
And by the way, you know, it probably is, it isn't necessarily bad after a meal to have a high cholesterol or high triglyceride. It means cholesterol is a transport molecule or structure of molecules, or cholesterol particles anyway.
Yeah.
Cholesterol is the chemical molecule, but a cholesterol particle is actually a shuttle that takes cholesterol away from the arterial wall in many cases. So, you know, that's an appropriate physiologic response to a high fatty meal, and triglycerides are circulating fats.
Yes.
So they will go up for a while. And
they will go up, exactly, but not nearly to the limit that, not nearly as high as a high carb meal will do that, which is what this milkshake is. Mm-hmm. It's not just a high fat meal, it's a high carb meal. Can we call it what it is?
Yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah.
So that's really it.
By the way, that's very old. And that's, I think, basically kind of speaking to the people who want to malign the high fat diet.
This was published online March 23rd of this year.
Well,
that's interesting.
It was rehashed.
It was rehashed.
Yeah.
Yeah. That low fat message the low fat dogma is refusing to die.
Mm-hmm.
So. It's really something. So Joel, they totally are out of touch with the latest findings. Or the biggest confounder in their study was the sugar, which they did not control for.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Here's a question.
Further the point is, it's not uncommon for me to have breakfast of eggs and bacon, and very little in the way of carbs.
Yeah.
You know, maybe you'll make the eggs with some, sautéed scallions. I mean, not sautéed onions or peppers. Mm-hmm. Make a veggie omelet. So maybe there's some carbs in there, but that's the breakfast I have.
Yeah.
And I have had for many, many years, and I have zero arterial plaque.
Yeah, and vegetable carbohydrates are the lowest in carbs. A grain serving of a carbohydrate, you may typically get as much as 40 grams and a half cup serving of rice.
A pepper may have a little bit of carbs.
You might have some 5 sweetness. Grams. Yeah. You might have 7 or 8grams if it's a red pepper.
Right.
Okay. That kind of a thing.
And and here's the other thing is a liquid is very different than a meal because a liquid hits you up fast. Mm-hmm. It's absorbed rapidly in the stomach and in the upper part of the small intestine within minutes and hits you like a freight train. So this is not a mimic of a typical high fat meal that might contain a lot of fiber.
Yeah.
Like if I have
a smoothie, an avocado smoothie.
Like I had a grass-fed filet mignon last night, but I also had a big salad with it. So that it attenuated the effects of the fat from the filet mignon.
Right. Right.
You know,
I was just thinking of a typical 1960s meal, a petite filet and an avocado salad.
Not a TV dinner?
Not a TV dinner. I think I just pulled that out of Mad Men or something like that. So that would be a higher fat meal. I would like to see how much the cholesterol was raised or the triglycerides after a meal like that, and no milkshake, and no dessert, no pie, nothing like that.
Yeah, I had some cashews afterwards.
Mm. Do you know cashews are a fruit?
Yeah.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
Okay, we've got a question from Bob. Dr. Hoffman, I have a family history of carotid artery thickening. I'm a 70-year-old male. My most recent CIMT and carotid ultrasound shows no plaque, but I have a mean intimal thickness of some numbers here. He has 1.07 and a 71. My cardiologist is telling me to take a statin, but I had terrible muscle pain when I tried this years ago.
They're looking for almost any excuse to give you a statin. It's like, he has met the prerequisites for taking a statin. The doctor held a mirror under his nose and it fogged up.
There you
so
go.
So that is
you're
that
breathing.
He's qualified to take a statin. So what that this intimal thickness is, and how old is this guy?
70.
Okay,
70-year-old male.
This is actually would be a pretty good score for an 18-year-old, because what they found is using this type of technology, they found that Korean War. I think they did in the Korean War. They found that the beginnings of atherosclerosis were found in young soldiers who were killed in the Korean War when they looked at their carotid arteries. So this is even more minimal. Is if there's no discernible blockage or stenosis, but there's changes in the intima, that means that this is the very beginnings of atherosclerosis. Intimal thickness is slightly increased. It's almost related to aging. Mm. I mean, I'd like to think that everyone could, die at 105 with pristine arteries, but it's almost virtually impossible. This guy has devastating side effects from taking a statin, and there's not a lot of compelling reason to take a statin. He's probably ahead of the curve.
Mm-hmm.
He could take a coronary artery calcium test, an EBT scan, and we could see if he actually has calcium, because he doesn't appear to have a lot of calcium in his carotids. It's just a little thickening of the intima, which is the lining. I'd say, again, I mean, it just so illustrates the
he's looking for alternatives.
Pain by numbers medicine. Can we talk about alternatives in part two, because we're running a little bit short on time for part one. In part two, we'll talk about, what was this direct question you said, that he wants alternatives to statins?
Yeah, alternatives to statins.
Okay.
For the intimal thickness.
For the intimal thickening. Okay. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with Layla Mutin. You can send questions to radioprogram@AOL.com. And we'll be right back with more of today's Weekly Q&A with Layla. This is Intelligent Medicine.